Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code's 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is school and sports. Each of my guests has a subject that covers either schools or sports, or both. My first guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has spent years writing for Newsweek and the New York Times, among others. She's written The Good School to make the thorny policy questions surrounding school understandable to parents. We'll discuss her findings. My second guest is an all-pro defensive player from the Denver Broncos who played in the 1990s. He'll share the lessons he learned from playing football and how those lessons apply to student-athletes and adults today from his book, Heart of the Student-Athlete. My third guest is a sports writer for the New York Times. We'll discuss about what he's written about one of the least known Hall of Fame baseball players, Stan Musial, in his book, Stan Musial, An American Life. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation or if you want to ask a question, you can call us at 639-0008. Peg Tyer is a nationally renowned writer and thinker about education. She is the author of the influential books, The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve, and The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. The latter was a New York Times bestseller. Peg specializes in making complicated educational research and thorny policy questions surrounding schools accessible to parents, who are the most passionate and motivated stakeholders in the national debate about education reform. Peg spent two decades in journalism writing about stories for Newsweek and feature and analysis for the New York Times. At the start of her career, she was a newspaper reporter and was part of a group of reporters that won a Pulitzer Prize. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, with her husband and her two sons, joining us from New York. Hi, Peg. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Well, I am terrific, and thanks for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Let's cut right to the chase, if we can, Peg. Are American schools falling behind other schools in the world? I mean, there's some research that says the OECD ranks the United States 500 out of 1,000 in reading, 487 out of 1,000 in math, and 502 out of 1,000 in science. Are China, Japan, South Korea, India, are they educating their children better for the 21st century than we are here in the United States?
I think maybe that's the case. I think, in fact, our schools are sliding a bit in their quality, especially as we relate them to the international benchmarks.
And what does that say? I mean, what, is that cause for concern here in the United States? What are parents finding, based on your research, about schools sliding in the national or international rankings?
What's really interesting to me is most parents are satisfied with the schools their children attend, even when the children aren't learning very much. It's a phenomenon that reformers call the happy school phenomenon. The parents are happy, the kids are happy, the teachers are happy, the school administrators are happy, but no one's learning anything. And so I think as a nation, we need to sort of shake ourselves out of that complacency. It's very difficult if you live in a low-income area to find a highly effective school for your child. That's changing. There are more options, but still, it's a challenge. In middle class areas, it can be the appearance of a school doing very well, but for some subgroups in that school, the school is terrible. So really, it sometimes looks are deceiving, and it's up to parents to try and advocate for their child to get them into the best school or to get the school they're in to do the best by their child.
Well, I agree. Parents have to be the strongest advocates, and I like that. The happy school phenomenon, it's sort of like a happy meal. It fills you up, but there's absolutely no nutritional value there.
Yeah, right.
All right. So are American parents getting the education that they're paying for in their taxes? Why or why not?
Well, I think that the role of the parent is changing. You know, it's just like how patients and the relationship between patients and doctors from 20 years ago. It used to be that we had a family physician who would take care of us from cradle to grave. And in the last 20 years, we realized, in fact, that model has shifted and that patients need to take ultimate responsibility for their own health care. They need to get their own information and they need to make their own decisions about the kind of health care they're going to pursue. And I think the same thing is happening with education. We're in the middle of some of the most profound education reform in our lifetimes. It's all based around school choice. Parents are supposed to choose the best schools for their children. Good schools will thrive, and poor schools will wither and die. But the problem is, as parents, how are we supposed to choose schools? How are we supposed to know what's right for our kids?
Well, that
My book is an attempt to help parents figure that out.
Exactly. I mean, that is the crux of the question. I'm talking to Peg Tyer, author of the book, The Good School, How Smart Parents Get the Education Their Kids Deserve. And let's take a look at some of the mantras for education reform in the United States, of which I'm just going to isolate three, Peg. Smaller class size, improved test scores, and longer or shorter school years. And let's start with class size. I mean, interestingly enough, ideally, people that are smarter than I am about this, say that the elementary school should have about 13 to 17 children in every class. But your research says that's not necessarily the best indicator of whether the child's getting a good education. Explain what you mean.
So small class size is very significant when children are very young. So between kindergarten and third grade, you really want to have small class sizes. For academic outcomes, after third grade, it's less significant that there be those small classes. At the same time, you don't want to have very, very large classes. I mean, most learning takes place in the relationship between students and teachers. So you want students there to be few enough students that teachers can know who's in their classes, know their names, grade their papers. But I've talked to a lot of parents who are prepared to move to a different neighborhood. One of the parents is going to go back to earn an income so that they can afford a parochial school, all in the effort of getting very, very small class sizes for their child when they're past the age when it's going to be that significant.
Interesting. Now, why is K through third grade so critical to have smaller class sizes, Peg?
Well, you've been around second graders. It's like trying to herd cats. I mean, they're hard. It's hard to, you know, get a momentum going in any direction with the 6 or 7 year olds. But I think that ultimately it comes down to the strength of the relationship between the teacher and the child. You really want to have those warm, connected relationships, especially in those early years. I mean, ideally, they'd have them all through school, but it's most important to have them early on. Also, teachers in those early years need to run continual informal diagnostics on kids to make sure that they're moving forward in reading and then grasping basic math concepts. Because when your child starts to fall behind in those early years, it can have very significant, very negative outcomes for them later on.
And what do you mean by informal diagnostics? That's an interesting term. Give us an example of what an informal diagnostic is.
Good first grade teachers know if your child understands simple phonics rules, like when the word ends in E, the vowel says it's a long name, or understands how to blend consonants, T and H makes the sound of F. So good teachers monitor kids, first of all, teach those decoding skills, and then monitor kids so that to ensure that they understand and can practice and use those skills, and are very aware when kids don't grasp them. You know, perfectly smart kids struggle in reading if they're not taught explicit phonics, and it's very challenging for children to catch up once they've fallen far behind in those early years.
No, that makes sense. My guest is Peg Tyer. And Peg, in the book you assert that learning to read well is critical to any child's well-being. And a tool that of instruction that you have isolated is called scientific-based reading instruction. What is scientifically-based reading instruction, and how does a parent know if that's being taught in his or her school?
So when you talk to neurocognitive scientists who look at language acquisition, they have reached the consensus long ago that we learn to read by sounding out words. And we do it very, very quickly. And some kids learn how to do it spontaneously, and some kids need to be taught it. It doesn't really have any connection to IQ. It's just some kids get it and some kids don't. And you need, so all kids need that kind of explicit instruction. When you get to elementary school and you talk to early elementary teachers, they're told in teachers' college that phonics instruction is one theory on how to teach reading. So there's a big gap between our scientific understanding of how we learn to read, neurocognitively, how we learn to read, and actually what happens in a classroom. So as a parent, you need to really watch out for this.
All right.
You need to make sure that your children are being first exposed to kind of recognized words, like lists of words like at, the, and. You know, words that repeat quite a bit, those are just words they're going to recognize right off the bat. They just memorize the shape of them. But those are very few words. After that, they should be sounding out words and have the ability to sound out words in increasingly complex ways and not be trying to recognize words from picture clues or trying to memorize text. Those are ways in which kids really do struggle who are instructed that way.
All right. My guest is Peg Tyer, author of the book The Good School. And Peg, I want to return back to some of the mantras of education reform. The big one that is on everybody's mind, very controversial, is improved test scores. And you go into some school districts, like here in Ventura Unified School District, some school administrators will boast that we've got good test scores, we must be doing a good job. Now, talk to me about that. How misleading is that, and the whole idea behind using test scores as the barometer for a school's efficacy? How important is that?
It's a super question. It's one I really grappled with, because I have to say I didn't really understand why people were carrying on in such a negative way about standardized tests, because it seems to me if you're going to teach curriculum, you should test kids on curriculum. It wasn't until I got with some psychometricians and people who put together standardized tests that I began to realize something very critical, that standardized tests are a different instrument than the kind of test that you're used to taking, you remember taking in 7th and 9th and 12th grade. In your classroom, when you took a test, there was the easy question, the moderately difficult question, and a very difficult question that demanded that you have a complex grasp of the material, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
But that is not how standardized tests work. Standardized test questions are all pulled from the lower third of the curriculum. So a standardized test question is only what psychometricians consider valid if between 40 and 60% of kids get it right. So if it's too hard a question, it's considered statistical noise, and if it's too easy a question, considered statistical noise and doesn't count toward the final grade.
Wow.
So all these questions are pulled from the lower third. So that if your school is teaching to the test, basically what they're doing is they're ignoring two-thirds of the curriculum in order to get kids to perform well on standardized tests, which is terrible. It's a terrible idea. It's like studying for the eye exam at the DMV. It's like, this, you know, there's a reason they don't let you do that, because we really want to know whether people can see or not before we give them a license. And it should be the same with standardized tests, but in fact, schools kind of game it.
Well,
they begin teaching to the test.
Now, you made me chuckle with the comment about the standard, the eye test at the DMV, but the reality is that that's a very disconcerting statement that you just made, that they teach to the lower one-third of the curriculum. What does that say about schools whose standardized tests slip from year to year as well? What does that say about the students and the quality of education that they are getting?
So we have this sweepstakes mentality as well, like, yay, test scores are up, the school must be doing good. Well, actually, people who put these tests together don't think there's any relevance at all when test scores go up for a single year. They take it over time. There's a kind of instruments that need to be considered over time, over a few years. And you really need to not look at the average test score, but force the school to break it out by subgroup. And schools do this on their websites. They do break out test scores by subgroups. But when it's reported, say, in the newspaper or in your local paper, they only do it by the average test score, which is essentially meaningless. So you need to look a little more carefully at what test scores really are saying. They're good instruments if they're used for what they're meant to be used for, but we use them as a barometer for all learning, and that's just not the case.
And my guest is Peg Tyer, author of the book, The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education That They Deserve. And the last barometer that I want to look at, or the last mantra that we have here in the United States, is longer school years. Now, it's interesting that in today's newspaper, South Dakota announced that they're moving to a four-day school week because of budgetary cuts.
Those 14 children who are attending school in South Dakota.
Well, now let's not use that tone. There, remember, South Dakota gave us Tom Brokaw, gave us Pat Summerall. So we've got lots of sports and announcing people that have all come from South Dakota. But putting that aside, the bigger picture is in the United States, 180 days are spent in school on average by students, compared to Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong, where they've spent between 196 and 201 school days. So talk to us about the delicate balance, not only between attending school for more days, but also the time off that the summer vacation allows students to have.
Oh, it's a super question. So there's a big tension in for school administrators between instructional time and downtime for kids. And here's the two bodies of knowledge that school administrators have to grapple with. The first one is the longer you spend teaching kids, actually actively teaching kids, the better they do. Okay, so that's not exactly like a shockerama. Like, if you teach them, the more you teach them, the more hopefully they learn. Right?
Right.
And it stands to reason.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
At the same time, there is a body of research that says in order for children to be at their cognitive peak, to learn most readily, they actually have to move around a fair bit. They actually have to have repeated breaks. So when thinking about the school day, school administrators have to balance those two ideas, that kids have to have breaks, have to move around, and they have to have sufficient instructional time. Now, there's been a big push in the last couple of years to enhance instructional hours, to make the school day longer and to make the school year longer. And the problem with that is in many schools, when they make the school year longer, they actually don't improve instructional time. School time is taken up with other ancillary activities, which really doesn't help the students achieve more.
Mm.
So it's sort of in play right now. What you see in some high-performing charter schools, for example, the KIPP program, they tend to run for a longer school year and a longer school day. They do Saturday schools in some places, and you're seeing more Saturday school.
Yes.
And if it's used in the right way, if it's used for instructional time, then it's going to enhance a child's achievement. If it's used for assemblies and for it's frittered away, it's not going to have a positive impact.
Wow. My guest is Peg Tyer, author of the book, The Good School. Peg, if people are interested in what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, I would like them to go to Amazon and take a look at the page for The Good School, which I think has a couple of excerpts on it, and decide whether the book is for them. I've got some reviews and some excerpts. Or they could go to my website, which is thegoodschool.org, or my Facebook page, thegoodschool.org, and take a look at what people are saying about it and decide for yourself. I think that a lot of parents will find this a very helpful way of a sort of quick and dirty dip into a lot of what can seem like a lot of arcane research and really help you become more sophisticated, become more empowered to have a good constructive dialogue with your child's school.
Oh, that's great. My guest has been Peg Tyer, author of the book, The Good School. Peg, thanks so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming. We'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.